Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we've reached a milestone here at Conversations on Healthcare. This is our 300th show. It seems just like yesterday. Well, not actually just like yesterday, but it does seem like we launched the program pretty recently.
Well, it was back in 2009, and we remember the nation was very focused on the healthcare debate. We felt strongly that creating a forum for discussion on these incredibly interesting and important issues was just the right thing to do.
Our first guest was the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and we've had a lot of Brighton top thought leaders in health reform and health policy, so it's been a good run.
In addition to Nancy Pelosi, of course, we had Senator Tom Daschle, public health leaders like Don Berwick and Tom Frieden of the CDC, technology innovators and thought leaders like Eric Topol and Esther Dyson, and even some of our youngest game changers like Intel Science Fair winner Jack Andreka, who represents such a smart and hopeful group of young innovators who are poised to really transform healthcare and science in the future.
So much has changed in such a few short years, Margaret. This show has proven to me time and time again how fortunate we are to have so many great minds shepherding the healthcare industry into the 21st century.
I am very grateful to all of our guests for sharing their knowledge and wisdom with us, and we in turn get to share it with you, our listeners. What a privilege.
We still look forward to welcoming many more guests to this show in the coming months and years. Healthcare, both here and around the globe, is still rife with much uncertainty. Epidemics like Ebola, HIV, and malaria still must be eradicated. And we're entering an era of care coordination, pay for performance, and a new focus on transparency on health data.
And that's something that today's guest is very knowledgeable about. Molly Ann Brody is the Executive Director of Public Opinion and Survey Research at the Kaiser Family Foundation. So we look forward to our conversation with her.
And Laurie Roberts stops by, as she does every week. The Managing Editor of FactCheck.org, always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter at CHC Radio. We love to hear from you.
And, you know, we couldn't do what we do without our great producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. California has become the fifth state in the nation to pass sweeping right to die legislation, signed recently by Governor Jerry Brown. But few approaching end of life will be able to access that option. The law states those terminally ill patients who wish to seek physician assistance in ending their lives will have to be of sound mind, be able to administer the drugs themselves, and get approval from more than one clinician. The law still leaves out a wide range of people who might want to be covered, people with progressive debilitating diseases that don't have an obvious 6 months to live prognosis, people with dementia, the fastest growing health threat in the U.S. California's Governor Brown has also signed another notable measure, a bill protecting children in foster care from being heavily medicated with antipsychotic drugs. Overprescribing these powerful drugs is a national reality plaguing children in foster care systems across the country. The California legislation, which covers more than 60,000 children and teens in foster care, will allow public health nurses access to medical records to monitor the foster children who are prescribed psychotropic drugs, identify group homes that rely most on these meds, and potentially require them to take corrective action. Johnson & Johnson has begun a clinical trial of a two-shot Ebola vaccine in Sierra Leone. The world already has one successful Ebola vaccine, with Merck and NewLink Genetics product proving 100% effective in a clinical study in Guinea in July. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Molly Ann Brody, PhD, Senior Vice President for Executive Operation and Executive Director of the Public Opinion and Survey Research at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She oversees all aspects of the foundation's public opinion survey efforts, including the monthly Kaiser Health Tracking Poll. Dr. Brody is President of the American Association of Public Opinion Research. Her research is published in multiple medical journals, including the Journal of American Medical Association, the New England Journal of Medicine and Health Affairs. Dr. Brody received her MS in Health Policy and Management and a PhD in Health Policy from Harvard University. Molly Ann, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You know, I think most of our listeners know that Kaiser Family Foundation's a nonprofit, nonpartisan health research organization. You also partner with a number of news organizations for public opinion research and analysis. Tell our listeners in this ongoing endeavor how research from the Kaiser Family Foundation helps shape U.S. health policy.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, our mission here is to make sure that the real life experiences and the views and opinion of people, real people, are part of the policy debates and discussion. So we try to insert facts and analysis into these discussions that can often be quite contentious. We try to make sure the voices of people, especially those groups that might not always be heard around the political tables, the uninsured, those who are most likely to have the highest healthcare needs, those with the lowest incomes or other disadvantaged populations. We just try to make sure that their voices and their experiences and their opinions are part of the debates and discussions going on in Washington.
Well, Molly Ann, the American public, those real people that you referenced, have certainly been given a lot of health policy to consider. Outline for us, if you will, some of the chief areas of public opinion research that's being examined by the Kaiser Family Foundation, and how has perception and or acceptance or not of the health law evolved over these past few years at the level of the American public?
We've been tracking the views of the American public for decades now, but on a monthly basis since the law was passed in 2010. As I said before, we mainly focus on their real-life experiences and their views, and we mainly focus our survey work on access to health care and the financing and affordability of that care. Now, what I would say about the Affordable Care Act is that what characterizes opinion on that act is, in fact, its stability over the 5 years. There has been so much contentious debate, and there's been a Supreme Court case, and there've been some, you know, presidential elections and midterm elections. But what we mostly see in terms of public opinion is its stability, and in fact, that it's from the very beginning, it's been viewed through a partisan lens, and in fact, that today. About 45 of us have an unfavorable view of it. About 41 have a favorable view. But what that divide really masks is an incredibly deep partisan divide. So Democrats have always liked the law. They liked it from the very beginning in 2010, and they still like it today. Republicans have never liked the law. They've always had unfavorable views of the law. They had that from the very beginning in 2010. They still hold that today. Those of us in the nation who call ourselves independents, well, we sort of look in like we have middle of the road opinions on the law, but when we push the independents to say whether they lean Democrat or lean Republican, we find that they have shared views on the ACA that completely mimic their more partisan colleagues. So if you can imagine, you know, data points for every month for the past 5 years, they virtually look like horizontal lines. So about half of people say they haven't had any personal impact with the ACA, but among those who have, about a quarter say it was a negative impact, and about one in five say it's been a positive impact. And that really differs, again, depending on your partisan leanings.
I wonder if you've teased out, and when you start to break this down into its constituent pieces about coverage for kids up to 26 and no pre-existing conditions, do you see a difference if you take out the sort of the partisan element?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. One of the things we saw early on is that many of the component parts of the law are actually quite popular and quite popular on a bipartisan basis. So people like the idea of kids under the age of 26 or young adults being able to stay on their parents' plan. They like the idea of insurance companies having to not be able to exclude people because of pre-existing conditions. The couple things that people don't like, you know, nobody likes to have to be told to purchase something. So the individual mandate has been a component that's always been unpopular, even on a bipartisan basis. Views of the law overall are as much a reflection of people's views of the presidential administration and of how things are going in politics than they really are about, you know, health policy issues per se.
Well, one thing that's certainly very personal to people is cost, and certainly out-of-pocket costs are on the rise for many American health consumers, and certainly the mandate to purchase insurance and then to choose based on your financial responsibilities and deductibles and copays, of course, have been really challenging for a lot of people. What are you seeing in your polling about the American public's feelings about this shift in costs and financial responsibility when it comes to healthcare, and how might public opinion shape future pricing?
When you get down to it, the thing that Americans worry most about in terms of healthcare is the cost of care. And, you know, they've historically been worried about it. They've been historically worried about the amount they have to pay for their healthcare services. And even though, you know, most experts and economists have said that we've had a kind of historic slowdown in the rise of prices, well, for average people, they still see their costs going up. You know, 3 in 10 have told us that they're not confident that they have enough money to pay for just usual medical costs. 4 in 10 say they're not confident they could pay for a major illness. And, you know, not surprisingly, these shares rise dramatically if we look specifically at the uninsured or those who are lower income. I think that, you know, what it comes down to is that a big chunk of Americans say it is really difficult, even if insured Americans. Insurance is no panacea, as we know. You know, a third of insured Americans say that it's difficult to afford their deductibles, their co-pays, and their premiums. So I think that, you know, quite frankly, it is sort of the underbelly of health policy, and you see that reflected in some of our more recent polling about the agenda that they'd like to see the new president and Congress take up, or where they'd really like to see some attention focused. And we were almost, you know, surprised to see that when we put things like, you know, the cost of prescription drugs, or, you know, prescription drugs for specific medical conditions on our list, that they just jumped out to the top. And I think at least some of that is that, you know, more than half of Americans take prescription drugs on a daily basis. And so it's something that's very apparent in their daily life. And so I think it's one of the reasons why that's a particular area where you see a large number of people tell us that they're worried about it.
We're speaking today with Molly Ann Brody, PhD, Senior Vice President for Executive Operations and Executive Director of Public Opinion and Survey Research at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She oversees all aspects of the foundation's public opinion survey efforts. Molly Ann, there are still another group of people who have benefited in terms of access to health insurance, and they have plans that are offering more than the Affordable Care Act. Sometimes they're called the Cadillac plans, which the Obama administration was hoping to start taxing in 2018. And there's been, obviously, on this side of the coin, a lot of pushback on that initiative. What are you hearing about the prevailing attitude on that subject? And more broadly, perhaps, how do Americans really believe health care should be paid for?
Well, first, in terms of the Cadillac tax, I mean, the name itself will help you predict what the outcome of the union is going to be, right?
That's right.
We are Americans, and Americans are not very fond of taxes.
Yes.
But what I will say is that when we gave people more information and gave them some messages on either side of that debate, it was interesting that opinion will shift with information. So if they were told that it might lower healthcare costs, right, which is certainly one of the policy reasons for the Cadillac tax, then opinion switched. On the other hand, if we use the arguments for the opponents of the tax that it's going to actually increase out-of-pocket costs more, then opposition can grow as much as to 75%. We have to remember that as much as Americans care about healthcare because it's such a personal issue to people. So when you ask something about, you know, how do Americans really believe healthcare should be paid for, I think it's tough. I know that people who have employer-sponsored insurance are, in fact, generally quite grateful to their employers for providing it and for helping to pay for it. They recognize that it would be very expensive for them to be trying to purchase it on their own. And we also know that it's one of the core benefits that people look for in a job, and that concept of job lock, that it's still very prevalent in people's minds. They, you know, get and keep jobs because of the insurance that it provides for their families.
Well, Molly Ann, you recently partnered with the Commonwealth Fund on a survey of primary care providers and found that while millions of newly insured Americans had gained coverage, it had not produced a significant additional burden on most practices. Tell us more about your findings.
You know, we're asking them about their practice capacity and asking them about, you know, whether they felt they had the capacity to handle patients. And there's certainly not a sense that they were getting flooded. You know, again, I think it's early on, and, you know, you have a lot of states who haven't expanded the Medicaid program. Even though, you know, there's been quite an expansion, it hasn't been at, you know, the rate that it might have been if all the states had done the Medicaid expansion. And so at least at this early stage, I think, in the implementation of the ACA, VA primary care physicians told us that so far so good. Doesn't necessarily mean they like the ACA. What was pretty interesting about that study is that physicians' views of the law pretty much paralleled the public's views, in that physicians who call themselves Democrats liked the law and physicians who called themselves Republicans didn't like the law. And their opinions didn't seem to have much to do with actually what was happening on the ground in their practices.
Molly Ann, in addition to being the pollster in residence at the Kaiser Family Foundation, you're also president of the American Association of Public Opinion Research, which is dedicated to the notion that good public opinion research is essential to the healthy democracy. Could you tell our listeners more about your organization's missions and goals, and how is big data changing the polling landscape, and how's transparency playing a role in the association's work as well?
You know, we believe this is a really, exciting and challenging time for the polling industry generally. Big data offers an awful lot of opportunities, but also some challenges. And I think that there's been some really exciting new experiments and new ways of thinking about how we actually measure opinion and how we can collect data about opinion. At the same time, and it's, one of the reasons the association has been so focused on transparency, because there are so many new methods and so many new ways of going about collecting data, we feel like it's more important than ever for people to make their methods and their choices and their decisions and their assumptions transparent to readers and journalists and the people who are consuming their data, so that people can make judgments on their own. APOR has a new transparency initiative, really with that goal, to try to make it easier for a journalist or for a potential client or for a reader to have confidence in the type of methods that were employed. In the transparency initiative, it says that they will abide by a set of rules in terms of what kind of disclosure information they make available. And I think that can give for journalists and for others on which organizations are producing information that at least are being transparent about the kinds of choices and decisions they're making.
It strikes me that one thing we can count on is public opinion sometimes does change over time. And one thing I am thinking about is the firestorm that was created in the early days of the Affordable Care Act discussions around the idea of providers and patients having frank conversations about end-of-life issues. You've recently conducted a survey on that topic and found that maybe there's been some shift in the opinions in the medical community as well as among patients. Tell us about that.
You know, the firestorm that you're, I think, referring to is when, Sarah Palin and others called a provision in the healthcare law the provision of creating a death panel.
Right.
Well, I can't imagine any American who likes the idea of a death panel. So the fact that there was so much opposition to that, or really to that wording, I don't think is so surprising. What we've recently asked is much more about end-of-life conversations. And it turns out that the vast majority of Americans support the idea of doctors talking to their patients about end-of-life decisions and choices, although, quite frankly, only about 17% of Americans say they themselves have ever had such a conversation with their doctor. About a third tell us that they have been a part of such a conversation, whether it be for their own care or for, for family members' cares. As the fiery language, leaves the headlines and instead we talk about a really tough, personal issue about the medical choices and decisions that are available at the end of somebody's life and treatment, I think that basically what we're seeing in our data is that Americans think it's important for doctors to be part of that conversation. They believe that insurance companies, including Medicare, should reimburse doctors for the amount of time that they spend on those kinds of conversations. And they themselves, want to turn to their doctors and to other trusted sources like their, religious leaders, their friends, their family members, most especially, to talk about such issues.
We've been speaking today with Molly Ann Brody, PhD, Senior Vice President for Executive Operations and Executive Director of Public Opinion and Survey Research at the Kaiser Family Foundation. You can learn more about their work by going to kff.org or by following her on Twitter at Molly Brody and at Kaiser Fam Found. Molly Ann, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
We're going to look at a public health issue today, which is firearm deaths. After a mass shooting in Oregon on October 1st, President Obama claimed that, quote, states with the most gun laws tend to have the fewest gun deaths. Looking solely at the numbers, the data back up Obama, but he went on to imply a causation that's impossible to prove with a scientific random study, that gun control laws lead to fewer gun deaths. He said, quote, so the notion that gun laws don't work is not borne out by the evidence. Let's take a closer look at the evidence. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention publishes statistics on firearm deaths and the age-adjusted death rate, which would be the fairest measurement to compare states. For 2013, the 10 states with the highest firearm death rates, led by Alaska, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, included 9 states that got a grade of F for their gun laws by the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, both groups that advocate for strong gun laws. The 10 states with the lowest firearm death rates, led by Hawaii, Massachusetts, New York, and Connecticut, included 7 that got a B or higher for their gun laws. But that's a correlation, not causation. The states with the most gun deaths also tended to have higher rates of poverty and more rural areas that can make getting to a hospital in time difficult. And 63% of all gun deaths were suicides. When we look only at homicide rates, 8 of the 10 states with the highest homicide rates and 8 of the 10 with the lowest all got D or F grades for their gun laws. Researchers at Boston Children's Hospital looked at 2007 to 2010 data and found a higher number of gun laws in a state was associated with a lower rate of gun deaths, both overall and for homicides alone. But that report said that it couldn't determine cause and effect. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. No parent wants to hear their young child's chronic health issues are a result of serious defects requiring complex and risky surgery. But that was exactly the case for 3-year-old Mia Gonzalez, plagued for years with severe life-threatening respiratory issues and multiple hospitalizations. Her doctors discovered the cause was a severe aortic abnormality that would eventually kill her without intervention. Dr. Redmond Burke, head of the pediatric cardiovascular surgery at Nichols Children's Hospital in Miami, would once have deemed her condition inoperable. So he chose a new tactic, create a 3D printed model of her actual heart to offer surgeons a chance to map out an approach to the complex surgery.
This was printed out because she was thought to be inoperable. And by having this type of model, we were able to conceive of an operation that hadn't been done before, connecting the small veins from her lungs up to her heart.
Dr. Burke said he carried the heart around with him for weeks, analyzing the problem from every conceivable angle, sharing ideas with colleagues until they agreed upon the best surgical solution.
Her operation was extremely successful, and she's recovering very well in the hospital now and is just about ready to go home. And now her life, instead of being measured in terms of days and weeks, is going to be measured in terms of years and decades.
Dr. Burke said that prior to 3D printing technology like this, they would have deemed her case too risky to chance. While scientists say creating stem cell-generated 3D printed organs for implementation is still years away, this method of deploying 3D technology could help surgeons everywhere create workable solutions to complex surgical problems. A 3D printed model of a patient's organ, offering surgeons a visual tool to help tackle complex surgical dilemmas, leading to better surgical outcomes for high-risk patients. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.